ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Welcome to another episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick financial journalist Ray Matlaka. Here's what's coming your way. Is government's plan to get off the grey list being hampered by some estate agents and lawyers? Then we talk the P word. No, not that one. We ask whether privatization is the answer. Later, Chartreuse Green, Coconut Trees and Brats. Kamala Harris' presidential campaign is giving.
I guess Kamala Harris's campaign team that is going so wild in the social media landscape is trying to appeal to that young demographic, who are called couch surfers, by the way, because come election day, they're sitting on the couch, they don't participate in elections.
And welcome to the International Space Station. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. But first, as Carte Blanche wraps up its two-part investigation into extortion rackets in the Western Cape, we ask what needs to happen to prevent yet another crime trend from taking hold. Ray, welcome back to the show. You know I always love having you. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Liz. I'm sort of like holding on. There's, what, 5 months left in the year?
And yes.
I cannot believe how fast 2024 is going so far.
I want us to jump into our very first story, and it's extortion rackets or protection rackets in the Western Cape. And I think when a lot of people think of extortion or protection rackets, you tend to think of the club scene primarily along Long Street, as well as the construction and taxi mafias. But there's another very concerning element of this criminal underworld that's making it extremely difficult for businesses across townships to really carry on with their day-to-day dealings. And this past Sunday, we focused on Khayelitsha and the many mass shootings in recent years that have been linked to extortion. I mean, it's gotten so bad that even street vendors are now being targeted. They're being forced to pay these protection fees. And, you know, previously extortionists generally targeted mostly foreign nationals, and now local businesses are falling victim, and even churches are being targeted, which is crazy to me. It's really, really getting out of hand.
And let's call it for what it is. It is bullying. It is illegal. It is crime, actually. And we are sort of starting to see the modus operandi of the construction mafia and the construction sector now moving into other sectors as well. I mean, your coverage in Khayelitsha was brilliant, by the way, but it just shows how desperate people are for protection. And where is the law enforcement agencies, by the way, when these extortion syndicates that are now becoming much more sophisticated and permeating through every sector of society? It's not only about construction projects that are being stalled or stopped because of these extortion networks, but also services such as waste collection stopping.
Yes.
And communities in Khayelitsha are really not getting any waste collection services done in these communities because of these criminal elements that have taken hold. Again, I ask, where are the police in all of these incidents?
We've seen as well that, especially in the Western Cape and with the gangs, that a lot of the times there are allegations of police involvement in these gang-related activities. So the question is, what is the solution? I know that Daily Maverick's Karen Dolly wrote a recent article in which she said that there have been 88 people murdered in the Western Cape in a 7-day period. And now there are talks of imposing a 24-hour-a-day lockdown in certain areas to, quote, dismantle the gang activities and remove firearms and gang members from the communities, unquote. But yeah. My question is that really enough? Call me a pessimist, but I don't see that really doing anything.
I'm not sure as well, you know, Liz. It feels like a lockdown. It would be like applying paint over a crack. back. You're not dealing with the underlying issues here, and the underlying issues is criminal elements. I think in our discussions, Liz, I always talk about, let's center people here. Let's center the lives lost. Let's center lives disrupted here. And at the heart of it, Liz, a lockdown won't really solve the issue, unfortunately. It's about law enforcement responding adequately to criminal elements and the law being broken here. If several reports are true that cops are implicated here themselves and are part of these criminal networks and are benefiting somehow through these criminal networks, then this is quite worrying. Then step one would be to actually root out any rotten potatoes in the law enforcement sector that are involved in benefiting from these criminal elements. Step two would be to actually capacitate the police to be able to respond to these criminal elements. I mean, some of these gangsters, Liz, if you're to see the kind of guns and weapons they have in their arsenal, I mean, this is like warlike weapons. And one kind of wonders, where do they get these sort of rifles, for example? So really here, this is a multifaceted issue that also deserves a multifaceted response from the police.
In February 2023, South Africa suffered a reputational blow when it was greylisted by the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, an intergovernmental body that assesses a country's ability to fight money laundering and terrorism financing. At the time, the FATF said government failed to adequately address state capture and corruption, while it also urged regulators to ensure major industries keep detailed records when it comes to the movement of large amounts of cash. So far, government has played its part, but estate agents and legal practitioners are being called out for failing to do what's needed to get SA back into the FATF's good books. Now, on to finance news, and I was quite surprised when I read a statement issued by the National Treasury earlier in July stating that it sees South Africa exiting grey listing by June 2025. But I want to know from you, firstly, why is National Treasury this optimistic? What is it basing its optimism on? And do you share that optimism?
Well, you know, I'm very, not pessimistic, but I'm very cautious in whatever I say here, Liz. Yes. And believing what the government says, I think we have been burnt as journalists before by just going with what the government has said. Well, the National Treasury has been having discussions with the Financial Action Task Force, that is the agency that greylisted South Africa last year. And in these discussions by the National Treasury and the Financial Action Task Force, the National Treasury has been trying to convince the task force that it has taken several steps to strengthen the country's anti-money laundering laws, measures as well, and regulations as well. So based on that, the Treasury believes that it is tightening its anti-money laundering laws and regulations. It is clamping down on corruption. It is making headway along with the law enforcement agencies in South Africa to prosecute state capture-related cases that are piling up in our legal system. So the National Treasury is trying to convince the Financial Action Task Force that the state is actually making headway in prosecuting state capture related cases. So I guess based on those interactions and progress reports that the Treasury is presenting, it believes that South Africa might exit the grey list next year. It's yet to be seen if that will happen.
Yeah. Now, the Financial Intelligence Center, or FIC, said it's pleased to see the progress that's been made to exit grey listing, but it's also identified three sectors it says are, quote, willfully standing in the way of South Africa's exit from a global financial watchdog's grey list, unquote. And these include some estate agents, legal practitioners, and dealers in precious stones and metals. And this for me was quite interesting. And it seems like the FIC has reached its limit with certain industries because it essentially said, listen, get your act together. You need to comply to these very basic standards. And one of them being submitting a very detailed questionnaire on how you handle money and how you deal with clients and all of that. that. So it's very interesting to see the FIC taking such a strong, heavy-handed stance against these industries, because clearly it's seeing that these industries are not playing their part in helping us get off the grey list.
And this is quite worrying, Liz, because it is these industries that actually led to South Africa being placed under a grey list. These industries handle a lot of money. For example, if you are in the real estate industry, agents would often process the purchase or sale of properties using cash. So let's say, for example, an estate agent has a property for sale and has a buyer that is interested in buying that property. Some of those estate agents would not question a buyer where they get the money from to purchase a property. So sometimes a buyer would come with money that was generated through corrupt practices or money that was generated through state capture dealings. And those buyers would use that money to purchase a property. And the estate agents would not question where that buyer gets the money from. So real estate agents did not do a due diligence on where money comes from. Lawyers, for example, if they had a client would just, like in the movies, by the way, just drop a bag filled with cash to pay for legal services. And lawyers didn't question where that money came from. So it was years and years and years, Liz, of those kind of practices which contributed to South Africa being grey-listed. And it's quite concerning that the FIC is reporting that estate agents and lawyers are not reforming their behavior. And that will really make it difficult for South Africa to get out of the grey list if that kind of pernicious behavior still continues today.
Privatize Eskom, privatize SAA, privatize, privatize. As many South Africans call for the privatization of several state-owned enterprises, Ray posits that it might not be the ultimate fix for our many struggling public enterprises.
Now, sticking with finance matters, I also want to talk about state-owned enterprises or SOEs. And last week, you wrote a really interesting piece on SOEs and the role they play in South Africa's economy. Essentially, you're reminding readers that as much as people are often calling for state entities to be privatized, that it's not necessarily the best solution.
There's a lot of debates currently about whether state-owned enterprises such as Eskom and Transnet, SAA, should be sold to the private sector, and whether the government should do away with those entities and hand them over to the private sector, because these entities have cost taxpayers a lot of money in terms of the billions and billions of rands of bailouts that the taxpayer had to pay to these enterprises to keep them operational and going. So I went back to the basics here, Liz, and looked at the role of state-owned enterprises. And if you look at the basic role of state-owned enterprises, they are meant to regulate industries, to not allow the private sector to have complete control of industries such as electricity, logistics, rail, and the airline industry. Because if these sectors are left to the private sector alone, then it opens up an avenue for abuse and the private sector charging us, the consumers, a lot of money for some of these services. And we have seen that if you leave these sectors to the private sector, then abuse can quite happen. And we've seen a lot of private sector companies being charged of extortion, running cartels, for example. There were cartels in the bread industry whereby a lot of bread manufacturers in South Africa charged consumers a lot of money that led to these companies being prosecuted by the Competition Commission. So essentially, I believe that there is still a big role to play here by state-owned enterprises in ensuring that there is competition in various industries and ensuring that at the end of the day, the services are delivered to the public.
You can head on over to Daily Maverick's website and go check out Ray's article. It's really interesting and it does get you thinking about who do we trust with our money at the end of the day. So it's very interesting reading.
On Friday, the 19th of July, several online systems went offline as roughly 8.5 million Microsoft Windows users were confronted by the dreaded blue screen of death. Businesses, governments, and vital industries ground to a halt as flights were grounded, banks and stock markets went offline, and hospitals were left in the dark. Locally, the damage was also felt as the city of Tshwane's municipal infrastructure was unusable, and Capitec Bank also experienced significant disruptions. Now, as the world counts the cost of this historic blackout, we reflect on a technologically dependent world.
Now, on to international news, and first we need to chat about the massive IT outage that impacted several parts of the world about 2 weeks ago. And this is, of course, after an update by cybersecurity company CrowdStrike that caused several Microsoft Windows systems to crash. The effect of this global outage, which has been described as the largest IT outage in history, will be felt by businesses for a while to come, with early estimates suggesting financial losses could run into the billions, which is just insane. Now, for me, this just served as another reminder of how vulnerable we actually are in this world of just permanent connectivity. You know, things go down and suddenly we're like headless chickens running around, unable to do anything. I mean, we saw Sky News going off the air. One of our local news channels also went off the air for a short while because things just stopped working because of this one little update that went out.
It just shows, this is more evidence of our dependency on technology and how connected the world is. And actually, through technology, the world is becoming smaller. And yeah, you know, I'm a Luddite. You know, when it comes to tech stuff, I'm not really sure how these things work. But again, it was another sobering reminder of how connected the world is and how small the world is becoming through technology, and how we depend on these technological advances to make life easier, or, as we've seen through this case, harm it.
Yes, absolutely.
Harm it. But it seemed like in South Africa, the impact was quite minimal, because on the day of the outage, I was flying locally, Liz. And yeah, it seems like our local airlines weren't really disrupted much. And if there were sort of technical glitches, they were resolved immediately. But I saw pictures of snaking queues at airports, moving very slow, people missing their flights. And in some instances, some flights were grounded as well too. So you really saw the impact mostly overseas. In South Africa, yes, there was a bit of impact, but I think it was quite minimal.
And, you know, strangely for me, this also feeds into the conversation that we just had about privatization and how much responsibility you hand over to certain entities, because this just made me think of how important diversification is, because we're seeing it more and more. You have one company that's in control of this one little element of our lives, and they go down, or they cause a problem that causes the whole system to collapse, and you're stuck. You're stuck with these large-scale blackouts. And just this just made me think maybe we should really revisit the whole conversation about diversification, especially when it comes to communication and technology, because that is essentially what makes the entire world run.
Indeed. And you know what? When it comes to technological developments, it is a private sector that leads with such innovations. And we're seeing it constantly, that sometimes the state or government agencies will often outsource their technological needs to the private sector. So the private sector's role in technological innovation becomes far too concentrated, that when one piece of technology breaks down, then the impact is not only felt by society, but even by governments, which is quite concerning.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? Well, it might feel that way if you only recently came across presidential candidate Kamala Harris' online election campaign. From calling each other brat, a term used to describe someone who's bold, unapologetic, and at times a bit awkward, to putting together short music videos. The Harris campaign is seemingly grabbing the attention of young voters who, prior to President Joe Biden's exit from the race, said they simply had no one to vote for.
Now, I want to pivot to American politics for a bit, and I want to specifically chat about Kamala Harris. She officially announced her presidential candidacy and received the backing of Barack and Michelle Obama just shortly before this recording. But I've been intrigued by her very unique meme-heavy heavy campaign strategy. I don't know if you've seen any of it. She's all over my TikTok For You page, whether I wanted it there or not. She just suddenly exploded onto my TikTok page with fan edits and, you know, the coconut tree references. And it just seems her social media campaign is working, because there was an immediate spike in new voter registrations within the first 48 hours of her announcing her candidacy. And it's just amazing to see the role that social media is playing. You know, you have Kamala HQ on TikTok and X, and you have fan edits, and it's just wild. It's just crazy. Have you seen some of the stuff that's been posted online?
I have seen quite a lot of those videos and memes going around. But I think all of these efforts are aimed at attracting young voters. The US has a problem that South Africa faces as well when it comes to elections. Young people who are eligible to vote, but just don't participate in voting for their own reasons, because they're so disillusioned. They feel that their vote does not matter, or they don't see themselves in politics. So South Africa and the US, and I'm sure the rest of the world, faces this conundrum of mobilizing young people and getting them to participate in elections. So I guess Kamala Harris's campaign team that is going so wild in the social media landscape is trying to appeal to that young demographic, who are called couch surfers, by the way, because come election day, they're sitting on the couch, they don't participate in elections. And yeah, Kamala is trying to mobilize that young cohort to get them out there to register and participate in the elections in November.
Yes. And, you know, it almost reminds me a bit of the same energy we got when Obama originally put up his hand in 2007. There was also this thing of like an entire section of potential voters felt like they're being represented. And as you've just said, they can see themselves in politics. They see someone that they can relate to. So I think there's that same energy for me almost around Kamala, and kind of seeing someone that speaks their language a little bit. And it doesn't feel forced as well. So it's not cringy. It doesn't feel like your mom's trying to be cool, which she's more like the cool aunt who gets a little bit tipsy at the family gatherings. She's more like that, you know? So it's really interesting to see this all unfold. And I'm very interested to see debates between her and Trump. Yeah. I think that's going to be something to really write about. So yeah, very interesting times.
You're absolutely right, Liz. And you make a very, very important observation here about the energy with Kamala's entry now, reminding you of the Obama campaign. This is very, very important. And I see a lot of people are making the argument that this election is about democracy in the US. It's a vote for democracy and upholding democracy on women's rights, gay rights. But at the heart of it, and I think what sums up what the election in the US, it's about, you have a former prosecutor, which is Kamala Harris, who is going up against a convicted felon, that is Donald Trump. I think that just says enough about what's at stake.
While you're stuck at work or in traffic, two American astronauts are dealing with a slightly bigger issue. They are quite literally stuck in space. You see, in early June, Boeing launched its first manned space capsule, called the Starliner, into orbit. It was a big step towards Boeing's plan to make reusable space capsules a reality. But the launch was riddled with technical issues, and now, nearly 2 months later, the cosmonauts are no closer to coming home.
Now, let's wrap up today's show with a story I feel has not been covered nearly enough, and it's a story of two astronauts trapped in space, which is crazy. At the time of this recording, NASA and Boeing, now Boeing built this Starliner capsule, they still had no return date for the astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sunita Williams. The astronauts they launched on the 5th of June. They were meant to return to Earth on the 14th of June, and now nearly 2 months later, there's still no new date for their return. There's talk of an August return date, but nothing set in stone just yet. It must be added that both astronauts are safe, as they're currently aboard the International Space Station. But I mean, for me, this is nightmare fuel, I'll be honest. Yeah. I can't imagine what I would do had I been in their position. What's your take on this story? Because it's just wild to me that we have two people just in space and they can't come back.
We just talked about technology, how technology can help us and also hurt us. And it seems like technology here again is at play. But you know, when I read the story, it kind of reminded me of that Titan submersible, that, you know, that,
yes,
with Ocean Gate, when those four or five people went into the depths of the ocean to go for an expedition to look at the Titanic wreckage. It kind of reminded me of that incident and how the world was just watching for the safe return of those people in that submersive.
Now, I have to ask you, Ray, would you ever go to space if given the chance?
Liz, there is not enough money in the world to pay me to go to space. So the answer is very short. It's a hard no.
Same for me. Look, I'm a huge space rock fan. I love all things astronomy, but boy, I don't know, hey. For one, I don't like small spaces. And secondly, I just, and this is the most important one, I think, for me, is I will just miss my cats far too much. So, I'm really not cut out to be a cosmonaut.
And those cats need you, Liz. They need you.
They need me. So I would much rather stay here on planet Earth. Thank you very much.
With your feet firmly on the ground, huh?
Yes, definitely. I'm very comfortable where I am. Well, Ray, this has been such a fun chat. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us. And yeah, I wish you a fantastic week further. And I look forward to our chat again soon.
Indeed, Liz. Always fun to be with you.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.